Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, this evening our special guest is Bill Sardi. He's a health journalist, and he probably has studied more about medicine than the average doctor has, because he's constantly reading and going over the literature and writing articles, and you can find those fascinating articles on his website, knowledgeofhealth.com, or askbillsardi.com. And he's just completed almost 1,000-page book on cancer, everything you really need to know, and unfortunately, is seldom talked about, or the alternatives that you have when you do have a cancer. But right now, let's get to Bill Sardi. Thanks very much for being with us tonight, Bill.
You bet. The big story in the news today, and will be for the next few days and maybe for the next few years, all about weight loss, obesity, diabetes, this epidemic that has gripped America, and what the food processors have done is created it so then it can all be fixed with drugs. And, of course, this is what we're hitting. Go to the New York Times today. Go to Eureka Alert. Go to Reuters. Go to MSNBC and see all the stories. You're seeing drugs being approved now, massively, new drugs for diabetes, but more so for the control of our weight. And this is our big problem. And, of course, every time we hear about one of these Fen-Phen or whatever they are, type of drugs, why, we know a recall is around the corner very soon. They're not even talking about any side effects with these drugs yet. But the market they're after is incredulous and unprecedented, because they're not going to treat just diabetics. They're after 54 million American adults who are pre-diabetic. And what we mean by that is their numbers are up, but they haven't really developed true diabetes yet. They're at risk. They're usually age 40 to 74, and it's about 40% of U.S. adults. And it's a huge market, and they want to medicate them, even though they do not have diabetes yet. And, of course, the medicines they can use, they're going to try and upgrade them to more expensive medicines. The one they want to start them on is metformin, which is a relatively inexpensive drug. But when you're trying to get 54 million Americans on it, this could be something. Even if they get half of them, it will be an incredulous expense, even with a very low-cost medication. Understand, we only have 12 million Americans on statin drugs for cholesterol. They want to get 54 million on these drugs for diabetes. And, of course, the whole market is just wide open now, as the FDA is giving them carte blanche. And really, it's remarkable what you read about this. As the doctors now realize these drugs are coming on, and what's actually going to happen as it all unfolds, because the doctor's going to have all of this, of course, thrust upon them, these new drugs, the salesmen besieging them with all these drugs. And the public's certainly going to hear about it on television. Could be the making of another Vioxx, because we simply don't know the side effects of these. We don't have one anti-diabetic, anti-obesity drug that's really withstood the safety trials yet, but let's see what happens with this one.
Well, I think, of course, really what concerns me is that certainly the people in the FDA know that, you know, that NutraSweet and MSG produces pathological obesity. But they refuse to, of course, address that issue. They've kept that information suppressed for a long period of time. So on one hand, of course, they allow things on the market that they know will produce pathological obesity. And then the next thing, why, they're going to come up with a drug to control the pathological obesity. Isn't it great? We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Bill, pick up the story there, because, of course, there's a lot more to the story. I know that you've mentioned there. There really are other alternatives than these fancy new drugs they're coming up with. But
well,
pick
there
up
are.
The story.
Of course, one of the drugs that catches our eye is Januvia, which is, of course, attached to Merck. Now, of course, Merck is the one that, that produced the Vioxx and the whole recall, the millions of dollars, the lawsuits, the cover-ups. And, of course, it needs to get well financially. And, of course, you see the FDA opening the door. So it's opening up a new class of drug. This is a new type of drug. It's unlike insulin therapy. Works in a totally different way to lower the blood sugar levels in the body. And that means we don't have any experience with it yet. Merck's stock has gone up 38%. It's regained this year. 20 million Americans suffer from the diabetes. And this is one of those ones they want to give to the pre-diabetics, even though we don't have much history with it yet. And they want to take this new drug called Januvia and mix it with metformin, the inexpensive drug, so they can raise the price, get the price up on metformin and say it works a lot better. And you're trying to read the comments here from the doctors. I mean, they say that the sales of Januvia will hit $1.6 billion within the next few years. It'll be $4.86 a tablet, $1,774 a year. And as one of the doctors said here, physicians and patients must brace for the full-blown blitz in sales calls and advertising. The stakes are very high. Two drugs are likely to get approved within weeks of each other, and the noise will be deafening, says one doctor. So we're just going to get overwhelmed with this.
But, of course, do they have any long-term studies of what this does 5 years down the line?
No, we don't. And, of course, the other drug that they're now approving, this is not the only one. We're just talking about these two. But a new drug billed as the magic bullet for obesity is Acomplia, A-C-O-M-P-L-I-A. And, of course, this drug suppresses the appetite, and it works in your brain. We get a little concerned about things that, that go working there. It does produce modest weight loss over time, and side effects seem to be lower than some of the other medicines, but we're not sure of that yet. And the big problem with all this, as one of the doctors said, is that Acomplia is about equal to what other drugs are today, so there's no great advancement. It works in a little different way. But it goes on to say that none of the studies of any of these drugs analyze the cost, and as this one doctor says...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bill Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill is just talking about all these drugs that they're putting on the market to control obesity. You know, of course, if people ate right and exercised, they wouldn't have the problem and get off of, you know, the artificial sweeteners and all the other things a lot of people utilize to lose weight without realizing. Of course, they produce pathological obesity in animals, and they've used it for years, actually, many years ago, to fatten animals up. And, of course, but they give it to human beings, and now, of course, we come up with a solution, all sorts of expensive new drugs, many different types of them, for the idea that if we could just get people to lose weight, why they wouldn't become diabetic or get hypertension and all the other complications. So, but there are no long-term studies with these. What will it do to a large part of the population 5-10 years down the line? This is a mass experiment, as they've done so many times before with the American people, and as they did with women, for instance, when they were giving them all estrogens for threatened abortion. And it didn't affect the women, but their daughters got cancer of the vagina, and their daughters got cancer of the vagina. But it took 20 years to find out that the experiment was a terrible tragedy, but, oh, well, it's just too bad. So they're massive experiments on the American people, and the average individual says, well, if the FDA released it, it must be safe because, after all, they're from the government, and we know they're there to help us.
Well, as seen on television, that's what people are going to be seeing. Of course, one of the doctors here from Yale University, their study on food policy and obesity, their center, and he says none of these drugs analyzed looked at regarding costs. And he says the fundamental problem is that if even one of these drugs caused significant weight loss, the cost would be so prohibitive that it wouldn't be worthwhile on a public health basis. We just don't have the money anymore for this, and they keep racking these up. And one of the interesting things was Gina Colata, the health reporter for the New York Times, points out that we're in a dangerous trend because when doctors give out advice on diabetes, the patients ignore it. The doctors may say, change your diet. Probably nothing is going to happen meaningful. The doctors can say, go here for some counseling, get into an exercise program. It's not productive enough, and so this is failing. And so the doctors are saying what they're going to do is just skip all that advice and go right to the drugs. In fact, one of the doctors here is saying immediately as we see candidates, we put them right on metformin. We don't even bother with the advice about their diet and their exercise anymore. And, of course, this is alarming because you're now taking and doing that among people who don't even have diabetes yet. This is pre-diabetes, and, of course, we're concerned side effects and whatever in this whole thing. But this is the new change, is to put people on the medicines even before they really have a diagnosed disease. And, of course, this has got people wondering, you know, just exactly where are we going as this drug model attempts to make up for all the sins of our diet and exercise and all the other problems that we have. So this is where we are going. Now, it's interesting because Robert Bissell, who writes for MSNBC and one of the few real good medical journalists in the field, pointed out that one of these drugs called Avandia, which is for diabetes, a number of years ago they did a study and they showed that after 3 years on Avandia, about 62% fewer people develop diabetes. Now, that's a spectacular number. But what was interesting is the drug cost quite a bit, Avandia. And what he pointed out was there had been an earlier study, a prevention trial with diabetes, and if they just took people and got light exercise and walking 4 or 5 days a week and a modest diet change, it produced a 58% reduction in the progression to diabetes. Now, that was almost as good as the 62% for the medicine. Now, the point is that the drug cost, $120 a month. So that's about $4 a day. So with that, might as well just send people to the gym. We might as well just give them a check, go down to LA Fitness and exercise. So this is our problem. They want to fit in this drug model to fix the problem. We'll tell you where the problem originates from in the first place because it's the food industry who's created it. But we have this tremendous problem, they're saying and predicting. This will bankrupt all Western nations, the tremendous obesity and diabetes that we now see, even among the young. We're now getting this among a lot of young people, and we're seeing it in these developed countries. Whatever it is that's doing this is doing it on a worldwide basis. There must be something at a worldwide basis. And, of course, I'm trying to write another book here about what is it all this about, and it's really about how the food industry has changed our foods so that it's engineered in this whole diabetes and the weight problem. It's not just a function of our self-control. It would be nice if we selected the right foods, but most of the people thinking they're selecting the right foods wouldn't have an idea that they may not be. So go down to the store, please. Go get your whole grain food. Go get a loaf of whole grain bread like my wife did the other day. And as I pointed out to her, why, there it is, the high fructose corn syrup and the fortified iron in there that's going to make this into bread that's going to cause you to gain weight. But more so, you're going to lose all control over your appetite, and you're going to start eating and not stop eating. You won't know when to stop. And this is what's going on with Americans today because it's the way we've engineered these foods. We've taken some factors out of our grains and whole grains. We don't have control anymore. It's changed the way that we make a little hormone called leptin. A little leptin hormone then goes to the brain. It says, fine, I've got enough food. I know I can just stop eating now. And that little leptin response has been tampered with. It's been interfered with. And now we're overeating outside of our own control. We don't realize this. They're tampering with our brain by doing this.
You know, what is there's a leptin in the whole grains ordinarily?
Well, leptin is made in the fatty cells, the adipose tissue that we have, so we don't, it's not in what we eat. But we need to make leptin in order to, of course, tell us we're satisfied, we're full. And usually that can happen by sensing nerves in the stomach if it's full enough just by volume. But what we're doing is leptin would normally be created and then go to your brain and you'd be satisfied and you'd push the plate away. But as what they're doing is by using high fructose corn syrup is that it delays the leptin response so that your fat cells aren't making a lot of leptin right away. And if you can just delay that response by 5 or 10 minutes, just imagine you're continuing to eat and look for another portion until you feel full. And so they're engineering these foods in this way. And we have issues with MSG in foods. It's trying to make things taste good and do these kind of things as well. So there are other issues in there. But it's the high fructose corn syrup that they've been able to take on a chart. This was all started by Archer Daniels Midland and others as they began to take corn and develop an inexpensive type of sugar that was very sweet. And they replaced sucrose with high fructose corn syrup. And so this is where the trouble began. And you can just see as the per capita consumption of high fructose corn syrup went up, the obesity and the diabetes rose with it. And this was particularly shown in the soft drinks in particular, because this is where a lot of it is, where a lot of it's consumed. But nonetheless, it's still being put into our food. Almost any processed food, if you eat out, you're going to get it. There's no way to know whether that's the sweetener in there. Canned goods all have it in now as the sweetener, puddings. I mean, it doesn't matter where it is, you're getting this. So it's very, very difficult. And we've just engineered all of this in to our system. And, of course, now it's just a giant setup to all be placed on the drugs. And of course, we're just little pawns here not realizing what's really, really going down. And, of course, a little interesting thing is that they have this body mass index. Now, the body mass index, to be fair, is a way of showing that you have certain kind of weight, you have certain kind of height. And so if you're really tall and you weigh a lot, why that it accounts for this. So it gives you a body mass number. So up to about 25, your normal weight, and between 25 and 29.9, you're kind of overweight, and then everything above 30, you're obese. So, but they've tampered with that chart. And you go back, you have to really go back and find some of the older charts. But nonetheless, surprisingly, after telling us all that we're overweight and obese and all this, they did a study on mortality rates based on the body mass index. So who had the least risk of dying? The normal weight, the overweight, or the obese? Well, it was interesting. 37% reduction in mortality for the people who were overweight. Now, I have a feeling that some of this is because the smokers are quite lean and they're more in the normal weighted group. But nonetheless, what it means is they're pushing this stuff on it when we might actually be a little healthier than they think we are. So they're getting us to think, well, I'm overweight, I need to be on this medicine, certain numbers are up, and this may not, we may not need any of these medicines at all. And of course, this is how this is all going down. We're going to buy into all these arguments, doctors are going to look at this, and the drug model will prevail. One of the interesting things that the Chicago Tribune pointed out last year was a three-part series called Craving the Cookie, and when we get to share it with you in a few minutes, we'll tell you all about how they engineered food so we would overeat.
And, of course, I can just hear those advertisements on television now. You ask your doctor if this medicine's right for you, knowing full well that the detailed people have been out to talk to the doctor, I had to convince them that they should be taking whatever this medicine might be. And this is how the game is played. And, well, unfortunately, the doctor's caught in the middle. A lot of these things you're hearing, he'll never hear. Go right ahead, Bill.
Well, last year, the Chicago Tribune did reveal the insides of the food industry. In the Kraft Corporation makes Oreo cookies. And so they did this wonderful report on craving the cookie. The brain is wired to love sweets, but are they addictive? And they went on to explain that Kraft began to realize through research that there's more to satisfaction in eating than just your tummy, that it has to do with sending reward signals to the brain. And that if they could engineer foods in a certain way, that certain kind of foods would send a reward signal to your brain, and you'd want more of it, and it would literally become addicting, because the parts of the brain that you're activating are the same ones that addictive drugs activate. And so this study went on. It's kind of revealing. And, of course, they got Oreo cookies with all these little chemicals in there that get kids and other people to eat really literally a whole box of the cookies. And so as they went on into this and explaining in the article in the Chicago Tribune, kind of interesting that there's another division of Kraft Foods. They have many divisions. I'm going to let you think for a minute and connect this. Do you know the other division of Kraft Foods that's interested in addiction? They own a tobacco company. And the scientists in the tobacco company exchanged information with their sister company at Kraft on how to get people hooked on cookies. The cigarette makers, Philip Morris, it's all part of this giant complex called Kraft Foods. And so they were able to take and use their knowledge about brain chemicals to get people hooked on Oreos and our kids to overeat. And it's all about stimulating the brain. This is the problem with the MSG issue. It does enhance the taste of things, but it's tickling the brain to do it. And, of course, we just don't know when to stop, and this is how this is all going. And to see how the food industry, while we're in the middle of an obesity crisis, is trying to make foods as nutrient-empty as they possibly can be, so that we will get a bag of chips or cookies or crackers, and we will eat it to the bottom because it's never satisfied us. That's their goal. They're trying to get us to overeat. That's their objective. It's difficult for us to understand this, that we've lost self-control by the many, many foods, and they put it right in our loaves of bread, foods that we think are healthy for us, that we hear are whole grain, all of these kind of things. They've all been changed, and so they're altered for us to eat more, to drink more. The soda pop, the fructose sweetener, again, turning off the leptin response in the soda pop means we don't know when to stop drinking. We go right through a six-pack of soda pop like there's nothing to it. And the sucrose in the drinks before would have, in a way, told us to stop. But the fructose blows right by all the signals in our brain. And this is where the problem exists. They're actually designing these foods for all of this. And then we are, it's not just self-control. They're blowing, what the biggest problem, I mean, right in my own home, we have a lot of these foods as I'm trying to educate my wife about it as I learn about it.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with Del Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill was simply talking about an article that appeared in the Chicago Tribune about a year ago, talking about, of course, how they had engineered the Oreo cookies so that children would become addicted to them and want to eat more and more. And, of course, Oreo is produced by Kraft Foods, and Kraft Foods has another branch. It's called Philip Morris Cigarettes. And so their scientists, of course, knew that tobacco was addicting, that you could actually play with the brain, that you could make people addicted. And they did this intentionally. These leaders of the company lied before Congress. And those of you who have seen the testimony know that they all got up and they lied. Oh, it's not addicting at all, not dangerous at all. And they knew it was. Nobody never went to prison for lying under oath there because, of course, if you belong to these corporations, in many ways, you're above the law. Well, anyway, according to Bill, the article then, where the scientists who work for the Philip Morris division dealing with addiction, then were able to get some of the information over the food part of Kraft so that they could actually begin to utilize that information to get the children to want to eat more and more and more of the Oreo cookies. And I guess they did a pretty good job, didn't they?
Well, they certainly did. And, you know, anybody who's grabbed a bag of chips or something one day and just watching a football game or doing something and then realize, you know, they eat more than they thought they would have, unconsciously realizes that the food industry has reached its objective. And they've probably gotten us all to do that. Now, one of the interesting things is putting so many people on these medicines. Another one of them is a drug called Orlistat or Xenical. It's a fat blocker. Now, it's going to be approved over-the-counter. It's been available for some time from doctors. But now they want to take a low dose and put it over-the-counter because they're after this market, too. Now, they're trying to explain to pharmacists, because this is an over-counter type of a medicine, and that is that if you don't lower your fat intake when you take this fat blocker, you're going to have some pretty nasty side effects. And it's going to cause hepatitis, gallstones, kidney stones, rectal discharges, excessive gas, oily stools. I mean, the list is pretty nasty and pretty common. And so they're running around trying to get this drug ready. Each of these companies arming up, of course, their guns with these bullets in order to fire them at the American public. We're just ready for this giant barrage of weight loss and anti-diabetic medicines. And now with this fat blocker going over the counter, we're going to see a lot of advertising to go down to the pharmacist and see him about this.
Now, you know, I think it's so interesting that how often we hear on the evening news all this talk about obesity, and they'll show all these obese people, and they've been beating this drum for about 6 months, obesity, obesity, obesity. They show the other people walking, and they show their fat stomach or their fat behind, and night after night, week after week, month after month, they've been programming our minds, of course, to focus our attention on the danger of obesity. And they know exactly what they're doing, but they just don't want the American people to know that, once again, their minds are being molded, their taste form, their ideas suggested.
Well, they're softening us up. The
right.
Public doesn't recognize that certainly the television networks are seeing a market for their advertising. And so they're going to soften up on the news before the big ads come. The marketplace, they'll do a favor for their new advertisers as they get the American public aware of all this. And then as the public sees the big problem, why then when the advertising comes and the FDA approves the medicines, everyone will be set up just perfectly to begin reaching and grabbing and, you know, running to their doctor. Some of them you don't have to run to the doctor. Now they're going to be over the counter, and you're going to be going for this. And this is how the advertising department at the television networks is, of course, seeing this coming. They see a new market. They want the advertising dollars. And so what's truth in reality doesn't count. All that counts is getting those dollars in. You're just little pawns along the way. And this is actually what's going to happen. Now, I see three different types of models for fixing this problem. Two of them don't work, and they're the only two you're going to hear about. One of them, of course, is the drug model that we're talking about. You have a disease, you're overweight, you have diabetes or pre-diabetes, or you're going to get diabetes, so we're going to give you a drug. The other model is the food model, and that food model is flawed. That's the dietitians and so on. They're going to talk to you. But remember now, the food industry got a hold of the food pyramid and corrupted it. So what happened in the middle of this obesity epidemic? The food pyramid came along and told us to eat more food. Not less. 17 to 26 servings of food a day. Can you believe this? And half of it is refined grains, which will just fatten hogs and it'll fatten you.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment here with Bill Soddy. And ladies and gentlemen, of course, we're being manipulated. It's about time you understood that. You begin to break loose and begin to think for yourself. And we'll be back in just a moment. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bill Sardi, and of course we're talking about certainly what they're doing, the food pyramid, how they've changed the food pyramid, and of course what they've actually put in a lot of refined grains. And it's not the refined grains you want. It's the whole grain before they're refined. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, the whole grains have actually been altered. They've actually designed and through breeding taken the whole grains and taken a very important factor out. We'll get more into it at another time, but it's a little nutrient part in the bran, and they've taken more of the bran factors out. For some of you who think that foods are healthy for you, let me give you two that I think you might put on a list as being certainly not unhealthy. How about Total Cereal and Kellogg's K? Now, would you say those are healthy for you? Well, they're certainly vitamin fortified. That sounds like what Bill Sardi talks about a lot. Got a lot of vitamins in them. And if you want to eat General Mills' total cereal, you're going to end up with 100% of your iron requirements in one bowl of cereal. Now, most people, you get guys eating cereal, they'll eat two or three bowls in the morning. And it's the iron that drives a great deal of the problem with our weight and obesity. And they've taken the bran factor out. They actually admit they had it in once, and they took it out. They have the high fructose corn syrup in that cereal. So you're going to gain weight. But if you go to their website, they have these pictures of lean people and lean silhouettes, and it's going to lose weight on something that you're actually going to develop diabetes and become overweight with. The same is true with Kellogg's K to a lesser degree, but they fortified it with a little less iron. But it's still not really whole grain, and it still has these other forms of sugarized cereal. So the only thing you can really go get are just cereals like cream of rice, something where it's a regular cereal, and use that if you love cereal. Now, you have to be careful, because as I say, it's the grains and so on that fatten the hogs. Just use that sense, that common sense idea, that they know this. This is how you create in meat, how you create marbled beef, is you feed the animals instead of grass, you feed them the grain, and then it makes them much fatter. And that's exactly what they're doing to us. So this is the model coming down. So let me go through these three models again. One way is to treat everybody with a drug. Second model is to overfeed them. This whole model of the food pyramid, all the craziness of the high fructose, the grains, all of this stuff, some of it being masqueraded as health food.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Bill Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill is simply saying that if you want to fatten up an animal, what you ordinarily do is, of course, you feed it grain instead of feeding it grass, and that's the way you get a fat animal with the marbled fat and the meat, and it tastes so good, but of course it's not good for you. And then, of course, he's talking about the three approaches to what's going on. One, of course, as far as obesity. And, of course, that would be, let's put you on a medicine. Let's put you on an expensive medicine. And, of course, then you're going to begin to lose weight. So pick up the story from there, Bill.
Well, the third model is actually, we begin to see it in countries and societies where they don't use pills. And we may need or want to use a certain kind of pills that are all natural, as you listen to my story. But the issue is that by their customs, by the foods that they naturally eat, they don't get heavy. And what happens is the models for this we see in France and Japan, Korea, other parts of the Mediterranean area, where the obesity rate is less than 10%. Now understand, it's almost like one out of three here in the United States are overweight or obese, and we have all this problem here. So there must be something that they're fattening us up with. And, of course, it's our foods. They're making this market by designing the foods for all this. So the third model we actually see is where they're actually using things like red wine. They actually use olive oil. They have a little a study that they were doing, and they were talking about how the people in the Mediterranean area don't get so heavy. And one of the things that they were talking about is a little molecule called resistin. And resistin has something to do with the fat cells and telling us to turn off our appetite and so on. And anyway, they were showing that they tested the ability of drugs to turn off this little resistant hormone. And, of course, metformin is one of the drugs that they use, an anti-diabetic drug, and another drug. They were both pretty strong inhibitors of this little enzyme or hormone. And but olive oil, the components in olive oil, were almost equally as effective. It's no wonder that the people in the Mediterranean area certainly don't have the obesity like we see here. Laboratory rats, when they were fed a high-fat diet and then given red wine, the weight gain was slowed. Their appetite was reduced. They didn't want to eat much more. Now, rats don't have placebo effect and so on, so you can really test it better in an animal here. This was all better than a high-fat diet alone. So what do the Europeans do? They're eating and drinking. They have the olive oil. They have the garlic. They have the red wine at the table. And this is how they're doing it, without medicines. It's part of their food. And so these are the kind of things that we see, higher fiber diets. Now, you can get fiber today in a little bottle, and they say it's soluble fiber. It doesn't look like anything. I mean, you want fiber that's filling, like you see in an apple and so on, but better yet, you want stuff from bran. That's what's really going to get you there. And for most people, especially females listening to this broadcast tonight, if you're struggling with your weight, you'll simply go get a very inexpensive jar of rice bran, with flaxseed meal. Flaxseed has components in it that handle all these issues. It really is whole grain. It will calm your own hormones, your estrogen, which is causing you to have a lot of hunger. And I put many women on flaxseed meal and seen their weight go down, their hunger, their appetite dissipates. They're still enjoying their meals. They didn't really change their caloric intake. They just weren't as hungry as before. And so then naturally the food volume goes down, and they didn't really have to think about dieting.
Well, how do you take the flaxseed meal?
Well, the flaxseed meal, now the best brand is called Barleans. I'm not financially involved with them, but that's a Christian family that runs it. Bruce Barlean is the president. They're up in northern Washington. But they have a nice canister that it comes in, a little dark black canister, and you get this and put it in your refrigerator and it stays fresh this way. And this is the way you make it work for you, because it needs to be a fresh food. And then you get a tablespoon or two and put it in yogurt in the morning, or in a little cereal if you really want. And then this is how it begins to work, and especially for the females, because it calms many of the hormones. This is for women from 18 to 88, doesn't matter who they are. And it really works exceptionally well. And if women are menopausal, that's fine, because it has molecules in it that act like estrogen if you're low in estrogen. But again, if you're high in estrogen, it calms it down. It knows how to do that. So it works on something called estrogen receptors. But if you want to calm your appetite, you'll see it in the health food store. It's called Fortiflax by Barleans. But many companies have flaxseed meal. It's very inexpensive. If you're getting it in one of the little bags, like you're going to see at Trader Joe's and so on, then you're going to have to get your own canister and put it in there and put it in the refrigerator, because it won't keep very long once you open the bag. That's why I urge you to try to look for Barleans, but because I want you to keep and get your full use of the few dollars that you spend. It's very economical. But what I'm trying to point out is that the model for all this is that we don't hear about, and they don't want us to know about, is the model of the red wine, is the model of the flaxseed meal, is the model of bran components that we have been taken out of our diet. Now, some of you have become familiar with my involvement with a little red wine pill, and it has some of these components in it that have been taken out of rice bran. They're put back in and so on. So we've seen people losing weight. So if you're more of a mind to eat a lot less food and not even have any of this meal and so on, why, then you can try one of these red wine pills. The one I have been involved with is Longevinix, and you can kind of check into that. But the whole issue is that we have seen many people effectively begin to lose weight and curb all this in a more natural way and not have to be put on medicines and still enjoy buying and getting good food. And so I think it is a wonderful thing. We do enjoy having abundance of food. We do enjoy eating food and of course, the time to sit down, talk, and enjoy our day. And, of course, we don't want to take that away from us. And, of course, do you think the French have? Do you think the Japanese have? No, and they're not gaining weight. Now, we need to adopt some of these things, learn some of these ways to remain healthy and lean and, of course, to not become overweight and recognize that they're feeding us a lot of misinformation. And when we look at information, now we're going to be going to a doctor. He's going to be telling us our body mass number is high and we need to go on a medicine because we're sure we're doomed to develop diabetes. We may not develop diabetes, and I think it's the medicine should become something of last resort, even among people that are really struggling and over 100 pounds overweight. I wouldn't put them on medicine. And so and one of the first things you need to do, oddly enough, when you're on weight loss programs is eat. You just got to eat the right foods, and you'll be satisfied, and you'll stop eating, and you'll slowly gain weight, which is what you wanted. If you start losing weight in a rapid fashion, then you're going to have the gallstones and the other complications and problems, which is really not what you want. So you need to kind of see a way to get healthy like these other cultures do, and they provide a great example for us, and that's why I point to them so we can get a little encouragement and hope that other people do this unconsciously without even thinking. And they're people that live in these other countries, and by tradition of the foods that they eat, they're able to do all this. And we can do it too and resist all these drug models that spending thousands of dollars a year on all these things with all the side effects. Why, the metformin drug, which they now is the one they want to put everybody that's pre-diabetic on because it's a fairly inexpensive drug, and it costs about $10 a month. But that drug causes a B12 deficiency. You're going to have massive millions of cases of vitamin B12 deficiency, but they won't even tell you about this, and they'll just put you on the medicines. So as all the heartburn remedies do, too, all the blockers for heartburn, you see they cause a vitamin B12 deficiency, and of course they never tell us that. You become fatigued and start to lose your memory and so on until maybe somebody comes along and tells you to take a vitamin B12 tablet and you start feeling a little better. Otherwise, you won't even know. So, and this is what's going to be down in front of us now, as the American public is just treated like cattle. This is just like sheep, and they're herding us in, and the corral is all for these medicines on diabetes and obesity, and this is what they're doing.
Well, now, basically, what you're basically saying is people then should be on bran, flaxseed, this flaxseed,
right,
meal,
right,
olive oil.
Right. Now, this is all true. This would all be on the to-do list, and of course, absolutely. Now, bran is a little difficult because as you get all bran cereal at the store, it's usually sugared, so you can't find it. But the real element in bran that does all this is something called IP6. You can get it at health food stores. You get the combination of the red wine pill and the IP6 and the Longevinex capsule, these kind of things. But this is where we go, where it begins to control our hunger in natural ways. But we don't have to eat more. We're going to eat less. But we're not going to worry about counting calories or doing any of that. You're just going to add these things to your diet, and you're naturally going to eat what Americans did 40 years ago. Americans ate about 1,000 less calories a day. Believe that. When I grew up, I mean, it was hard to believe, but I can remember desserts and things were once a week, those kind of things. Now we kind of have desserts every day, but you know, we're eating more, and there has to be a good reason why. And of course, people don't overeat in these other countries. We don't see animals overeat. Now they have bred a little mouse so that he will perpetually overeat. They've blocked his leptin receptor. So as the fatty cells make leptin, and then it sends it up to the brain to tell us we're satisfied, we've eaten enough, that little receptor site to tell the brain that won't let it in. And that little mouse will eat and eat and eat. He perpetually eats. He never stops eating. And he's round. He looks like just like a little round ball. In fact, you can take him on the lab table there and roll him across. I mean, that's how silly this is. And so they bred this little mouse like this. That's exactly what they're doing to the American public and making all these people obese and getting them on all these medicines. And, of course, the easy way is just to collect the taxes and get the taxpayers to pay in these insurance programs, and then they don't have to make it so harmful out of our pocketbook. And then we're real happy because somebody else is paying. And, of course, this gets to be a terrible problem. The obesity problem is all over the country, but it's in particularly in poor areas of the country. Mississippi, Louisiana, West Virginia are the three states that stand out. Also, in the northern climates, there are areas, and particularly Wisconsin, the dairy state, stands out. So these are the areas that they're having the problem. These people won't be able to afford these medicines. They'll go on public assistance, and the taxpayers will then pay for all these medicines as they dream up how to combine one medicine with another and then up the cost, and one medicine and then another and then another. And, of course, all of these have the side effects and the other issues going on. So it becomes real easy when somebody else is paying the bill. And we're in this programmed situation now. Just like they would have fattened the cattle in a herd, they've fattened the American public. The food system has done this, the food purveyors. They've done all this, particularly the combination of iron-fortified diets along with the removal of the bran factors out of grain, and then, of course, the addition of the high fructose corn syrup. Then we see MSG, of course, has gotten in here. We see there are other issues for, particularly for women with the high estrogen issue, making them hungry because God kind of puts a little system in women to eat when it comes time to maybe they're going to get pregnant. But as they have other periods of life when they have high hormone levels, they'll still feel hungry and overeat. So as we get all these things under control, and begin to understand how to really deal with the weight factor, then we'll start having success on our own. The best diet plan is one that you develop, because then you internalize it. All of these, the certain kind of diets that we have, Atkins diet, various things, you can read a book and adopt somebody else's diet. But the best diet that you can get is actually one that you formulate. Make a to-do list. Here's the things to add. Here's the things to avoid. And, of course, you start looking for high fructose corn syrup. Go ahead. Start looking. You'll start making progress in your diet already and start moving things and realizing that you're just being a pawn to the whole system as they move the entire society this way and want to create another new blockbuster drug category. And they're doing it now by approving these drugs and going to get at least 54 million Americans as pre-diabetics on the medicines, and then all the existing diabetics and so on will be on this, and they will be no healthier. And in fact, most of the diabetic medicines actually cause weight gain, if you can believe this. So it just perpetuates the problem because you get heavier. Well, then you do have more insulin resistance. You can't make enough insulin to meet all the needs. So it does create issues. So we're just being manipulated, and I'll have all this written down and cited in a book. I am writing a book with a Dr. Francesco Facchini, who's now in Switzerland, was at Stanford University, and he has the most profound answers for solving this problem. And, of course, it was through my recognition and communication with him over the last few years that we decided to write a book together so we could explain this and get some alternatives out here to the American people. Unfortunately, the American free enterprise system is being, has no ethics. It has no compass. And so it's fine if we get people to overeat, use more of our foods, or need more of our gasoline, or whatever it is, why they don't see anything wrong with any of it there. And so this is where we are today, as they've manipulated our food system. And we're just the pawns. Unless someone comes along and makes us aware of this, we're going to have a lot of things in our own diet, in our own kitchens, and we're going to pay the price with this, as so many of us are, and we're going to see this ruin our health and our lives and be in financial ruin as well. So So we don't want this. This is the market they're softening up for us. They're using the television networks to soften us up as they get us all accustomed to this so that they can sell more advertising and they can make more money. It's not a win-win relationship. The television networks, the drug companies, they win, you lose. So if you're really going to get something out of these pills they're selling, that'd be fine. But this isn't really the way to fix your problem. As the New York Times says today, it's going to become a complete drug model. They're not even going to worry or be concerned or prescribe exercise or a better diet at all.
Well, now, Bill, as far as, is this going to be written up on your website at all?
Yeah, I'm writing this as fast as I can so we can get it all on.
All right, that's knowledgeofhealth.com. That's knowledgeofhealth.com or askbillsardi.com. And go there. You'll learn a lot more than you will from most medical professionals. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Bill, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Of course, you listen to the story tonight, whether it's about the Oreo cookies or about our whole grains, about the sugars and how they changed them. All of this were steps. I don't know exactly they knew all of the steps as they were making them, but certainly it's all combined into this tragedy that we see now where so many Americans, they have to really calculate every month this issue on how many people are diabetic and how many people are awake, because the numbers are rising that fast to have accurate idea of what's going on. So unless we find a way to escape on our own, get enough information, we're just not going to be able to get out of this, and we're going to wonder why our exercise programs and our own diet programs were on. You may lose weight for a while, but if you don't deal with the real issues, then and control some of these factors that in your food system, then you're going to have the typical failure of going back to the same weight because you still have the same hunger going on. The point is to do this with all natural molecules, not to have to rely on these synthetic ones, and to find ways to make this all work for you. We gave you some inexpensive tips tonight. The Barlean's flaxseed meal, using olive oil in your diet, maybe a little glass of red wine. We don't want to certainly give people license to over-imbibe, and certainly maybe red wine pills would work for many people that find that a little more acceptable. But these are the directions that we can head ourselves in and use the kind of ways that people do in the Mediterranean area, France, and elsewhere. More fiber in our diets and so on, and make it all work for us, as I hope it will for you. And be wary, and please go to your food cupboard and look at some of these foods again and see that you have there, and make sure you try and get some of these fructoses and so on out of the cupboard so that you're not letting it ruin your pancreas and so on.
All right, we're just about out of time, Bill. I really appreciate so much you being with us. And it should be so obvious to anybody who watches television that they keep hammering away at this issue. And you ask why do they keep hammering away at the obesity issue? Why do they keep showing fat people and telling us this terrible plague? Well, ladies and gentlemen, they've been planning this for a long time. And as we said earlier, our minds are molded, our ideas suggested, thoughts are created largely by people we have never heard of. Thanks very much for being with us, Bill. We'll look forward to talking again real soon.
Okay, good night.
Good night. God bless. I think that was a great, great presentation. I hope you enjoyed it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed Bill Sardi this evening. I understand that he spent a lot of time studying this, and I believe he's absolutely right. And I believe that there's a great deal that you can do, but you're going to have to begin to learn about these things. If you'd like to get a copy of tonight's tape, why, of course, they're available from Radio Liberty. In fact, we have put together a four-tape set on Bill Sardi, the wisdom of Bill Sardi. We're in the process of putting that together. We already have a four-tape set of certainly life-saving secrets from Dr. Russell Blaylock. If you have not yet read Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. That's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. You need to get it. You need to read it. And, of course, you need to understand that Our health is under attack today, and most of what is being put out by the government is not healthy at all. In fact, what they've done is they've taken the food pyramid, they've told us to eat things that they knew were unhealthy for us, and look at the health of the American people. I mean, we have rising rates of cancer, we have rising rates of diabetes, we have rising rates of hypertension and heart disease, and it isn't happening by accident. And we have an epidemic of obesity in America. Didn't happen by accident. Do you know a better way to destroy a nation than to destroy the health of the people? You say, who would want to do that? Well, ladies and gentlemen, there really are people who hate America and everything it stands for. And if you hated America, where would you go to work? Where would you have the most influence to do the most harm? Well, those are rhetorical questions, but I've been to the CDC and spent time there, and I will tell you there's some people there whose job it is not to take care of us, but actually to do harm and to conceal the truth from the American people. I was never as shocked in all my life as when I spent 3 days at the CDC. Well, that's getting into an entirely different subject, but certainly if you'd like to get the books we talked about, the number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Let me remind you that we are having our yearly Radio Liberty seminar. It's going to be on October 29th. That's a Sunday, and of course, we have to have reservations in by the end of this week. Next Monday would be the cutoff day. If you're going to come, why, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. We're pleased with the number of people who have signed up, but we still have room there. We're going to be a serving lunch. We're bringing in Constance Cumby. We're bringing in Chris Pinto from Southern California. Got a great lineup of speakers. Going to have a lot of great information there, information that you need to have in times like these. So, remember, America is under attack today. If you'd like to come to the meeting, 1-800-544-8927. How do you make any sense out of what we're saying? Well, perhaps if you were to get our syllabus and our talk on the hidden agenda. Now, that specifically deals with the water fluoridation issue and, of course, how water fluoridation is being used to a decreased fertility and to lower the intelligence. Yes, it does. It has an impact on the brain to lower testosterone levels. Why do you think so many men have sexual dysfunction today? They know what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know. A lot of it has to do with population control. And, of course, they have intentionally lowered our own population to justify bringing in massive numbers of immigrants throughout the world. As we move from being an American country to a multicultural, multilingual society, that is the plan, that they know exactly what they're doing. They just want the American people to know. It was announced simply yesterday or today that over half of the people in America are not married. They're living usually with, we used to call it living in sin, now they're simply living together. This was planned long ago. If you go into family planning perspective, we have sent you the page from their publication. Back in 1970, they were talking about how to control the population by, of course, using the marriage tax and discouraging people from getting married. They control so much of what we do. Pray for America. Understand what we're up against. And, of course, pray for our certainly pray for a revival in our nation, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and we'll be back in just a moment here with another fascinating program. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America, ordinarily at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or and here in the Central Coast of California, it's 464-8295. But please do not call in, because we're not going to take any calls, at least unless we ask for them. We have a special guest this evening. His name is Dr. Martin Erdman. He's written a fascinating book entitled Building the Kingdom of God on Earth, the Church's Contribution to Martial Public Support for World Order and Peace from 1919 to 1945. Now, Dr. Erdman is a scholar. The book was the basis of a doctoral thesis. And Dr. Erdman has researched a lot of the information that I researched probably 25 years ago when I was trying to understand what was going on in the world. And, of course, much of this gets back to Oxford University. It gets back to a man named John Ruskin, who was a professor at Oxford in the period of 1870, 1880, 1885. And, of course, he had a profound impact on a whole generation of the young aristocracy of Great Britain at that time, and infused them with many of the ideas of Plato about how if we could just have an ideal world society, a community where all people would help other people, it was sort of a utopian view. But he challenged them to spend their lives pursuing his goal of transforming the world. And here we are, of course, 150 years later, the world is being dramatically transformed, and really is a direct byproduct of this. Well, the book deals primarily with John Foster Dulles. And the book covers the period between 1919 and 1945. Dr. Erdman, are you there?
I'm here.
I appreciate so much your getting up. It's about 6 o'clock in Switzerland, where Dr. Erdman is at the present time, and he's working on a project over there, a two-year project. And the video, it's more or less on the ethics of nanotechnology. Is that it?
It is correct.
All right, fine. Well, I was fascinated to read your book, and I felt like I was, getting back in touch with some of the people I'd read about many years ago, Philip Kerr, Lionel Curtis. So I'm going to let you tell the story as you've taken this really from the time immediately after the First World War, and of course the disillusionment that many of the people felt that after all the horrible sacrifice and tragedy of World War One, why, in case instead of having a peace, instead of having a just peace, has been promised the 14 points of Woodrow Wilson. Why, of course, everything was betrayed by the European leaders, and certainly both England and France and Italy and America. All of the idealism that it motivated our people to lead America into that senseless war was for naught. So you pick up the story there, Dr. Erdman.
Yes, this is very correct, what you just said. I started at the end of the First World War to trace the story to the end of the Second World War. And my purpose behind writing this book was to show that these internationalist ideas, which were promoted by the League of Nations, were taken up by John Foster Dulles and his friends to eventually come up with the idea to set up the United Nations organization at the end of the Second World War.
And what they really wanted was a world government, wasn't it?
A
new world order.
This is correct. They used euphemistic language to hide the fact that their real ambition was to set up a world government.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Erdman. It's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating read. The book, A Building, the Kingdom of God. Well, Dr. Edman, you pick up the story there. And, of course, you were just saying that they concealed what they were doing. They used the Protestant churches in the United States to actually push this goal without the knowledge of most of the people within the Protestant churches.
This is correct. And they had a specific purpose behind using the churches. They knew that the American public would not be too thrilled to join a international organization. And so they thought they needed to condition the American mind to accept that idea. And the only organization they thought would be able to accomplish that goal were the churches.
And, of course, unfortunately, we see them using the churches here today. But, of course, you're talking about the time that long, long ago. And, of course, one of the things they stressed was the use of propaganda to influence the people to get them to go along with the program. In other words, they were going to tell what the people what the program was, but they were going to use propaganda to change their views. Wasn't that true?
That is very true. They used propaganda, but not saying it is propaganda. They said, well, we want to build the kingdom of God on earth. This is exactly what the Bible tells us. And thus, the Christian should get behind that idea. But obviously, this is not what the Bible really said. The Bible never said we should be engaged in a political scheme to set up a world government.
But, of course, they utilized that, and, of course, you actually start the book out with a wonderful quotation from Charles Spurgeon, that great Protestant minister, Calvinist minister, who preached so well in England, you know, during the 1800s. And basically, Spurgeon, you know, talked about that God was in control, man wasn't in control, but these men really wanted to more or less replace God, didn't they, and bring the kingdom of God to earth on their own.
This is correct. Yes. Ultimately, it was not a Christian idea at all. It was really at its heart a very anti-Christian idea and movement. And yes, I did quote a Spurgeon, one of his sermons, where he tries to highlight the fact that, yes, God is sovereign. And man has always tried to dethrone Jesus Christ from his rightful place as the king of the universe. And man has tried to take up that place himself, but God will not allow it ultimately.
And of course, the thing is that nothing has really changed. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Dr. Martin Erdman, and Dr. Erdman is engaged in a project over in Switzerland of evaluating the ethics of nanotechnology. Now, we're not going to get into that at all, but, there are many ethical issues that face the world today. And, of course, so many of the ethical issues really get, you know, into this pragmatic idea: can man remake the world, and can man bring the kingdom of God to earth? And that's really the title of the book, which I'm holding. And, of course, it really goes into the background of what John Foster Dulles did. Now, John Foster Dulles was a brilliant gentleman, as you remember, he in 1953, although this is not covered in the book, but in 1953 he became Secretary of State, and his brother was the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and these people were directing American foreign affairs and policy towards creating this world government that they'd given their whole lives to establish. And, of course, they were working in conjunction with a group of intellectuals over in Great Britain, weren't they? This was sort of an Anglo-American effort, but they didn't want the public to know what was really going on.
This is correct. They worked very closely together, these gentlemen in Great Britain and John Foster Dulles with some of his friends in America. It was at that time a global effort, really, because some of these Englishmen were also very much engaged in South Africa, and Lionel Curtis himself traveled the world. He went to Canada, to New Zealand, to Australia, to convince the politicians over there also to come on board and support that scheme to set set up a world government.
And, of course, this really, Lionel Curtis was part of a group that was known as Milner's Kindergarten. And really, of course, although I know you don't deal with this part of the history of the Boer War in South Africa, this is really pivotal to this entire movement towards world government, isn't it? And certainly the relationship between the man you've referred to as Lionel Curtis and then there was Philip Kerr, and so many of the other people who were in this globalist movement to create a world government came out of Milner's Kindergarten.
Yes. I do touch on that aspect a little bit in one of the chapters, but I don't go into great detail. But it is important because they used South Africa as the first test case. They wanted to unify the different states in South Africa, and they eventually succeeded to unify that country under British rule, and then they used that experience to unify the British Empire as they thought they would be able to. But then they ran into a lot of problems and realized that this would not succeed, and they disbanded that project to use the British Empire as the unifying force to unify the whole world.
And, of course, really what was so tragic is they started out, we're going to bring world peace, and how are we going to do it? We're going to have a war, and they created the Boer War in South Africa. And then, of course, the next thing was that they're going to unify the world and bring about world peace, and that was the slogan for the First World War. The war to end all wars, and that's what many people thought about it. We're going to fight this war in Europe, but it's the end war to end all wars. And so apropos today with what we talk about in Iraq, you know, the war to make the world safe for democracy.
This was the slogan from the very first day, and obviously it was a pretense. There was not a real, genuine desire to have peace, because they needed a problem to present the solution of a world government, which they eventually did through the churches.
And I really think that is exactly what's going on today. In other words, we have to have a problem to justify the coming world government. But let's get back, of course, to your history, which really deals with this period from 1919 to 1945, and the part that John Foster Dulles and the Federal Council of Churches played. Now, most people don't even remember the Federal Council of Churches, but it was really played a dominant role in the United States, didn't it, during that era, and then perhaps even working with the World Council of Churches throughout the world, pushing this idea of men bringing about this new world order.
This is correct. Obviously, the Federal Council of Churches was a council of some Protestant churches in the United States. At the time, they had about 30 million members. But it was not a grassroots movement at all. It was a movement which started at the top. Some individuals within the Council of Churches were using that organization for their purpose. And they're using the money which came from the individual church members to finance the scheme. It was a top-down directive. It was not a grassroots movement at all.
But, of course, everybody thought that with so many of our Christian organizations, this represents the people, whereas it, of course, it really doesn't. And then, of course, weren't there a lot of people of great wealth, both in Great Britain, like Lord Cecil, and here in the United States, like people affiliated with J.P. Morgan, specifically people like Thomas Lamont, who were actually helping to finance this movement towards world government?
Yes. Again, this is very correct. Don't forget the Rockefellers.
All right, the Rockefellers.
Very much involved in that too, especially on the end of financing the movement. And they set up two organizations which really merged into one organization, the International Organization in Great Britain, which eventually merged with the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States. I will say it again, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London.
But of course,
the Council on Foreign Relations.
they really didn't want the American people to realize that the Council was really a sister organization to the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So didn't they actually sort of try to deceive the people to think they were separate, whereas in truth they were really almost one organization?
Yes, that is correct. A number of these individuals came together at the Peace Conference in Paris, 1919, to set up that, as they called it initially, the Institute of International Affairs. But some of the founding members were also American delegates at that peace conference. And back in the States, they had already set up the Council on Foreign Relations. And then they thought, well, we have similar, if not identical, objectives which we want to achieve, and it would be better to join forces. But in order for the American public not to know that we work together, we keep both organizations apart organizationally, but we work hand in hand nevertheless.
And so it's really all based upon deceit and deception. So much of what this whole movement has, you know, if you're going to do something for God, you do it out in the open. You don't do it behind the scenes, and you don't try to deceive people what you're up against. Well, of course, you know, you go into really what happened there at Versailles, as they were negotiating the peace treaty with Germany, and that's just so really so tragic. When, of course, you know, the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, had promised the Germans that, you know, that he would abide by the peace treaty of the 14 points. There would be nobody held responsible for the war. Certainly, you know, they would simply, each side would go back to where they were before, and all Germany had to do was agree to the peace treaty. And the President of the United States gave his word, as did Clemenceau in Orlando. Clemenceau was the Prime Minister of France, a premier, and certainly Orlando in Italy, and Lloyd George in Great Britain. They all promised, you know, of course, to go along with this idea of, you know, nobody, of course, was to be criticized for the war. And then, of course, then once the armistice had been signed, then, of course, came the mailed fist. And so would you like to deal with that? Because that was really what led to the, laid the groundwork for the Second World War. And that was really a time when every American should have held their head in shame because our leaders lied to the Germans.
This is correct. The armistice agreement basically said that Germany was not really guilty to start the First World War and would not be asked to pay the reparation payments. But then President Wilson initially went along with that, but changed his mind later on to go along with the British and the French to say, yes, Germany was the sole country which was guilty to start the First World War and thus would be asked to pay or forced to pay all these reparation payments, which went into the billions at the time of German marks. And it was really a betrayal. But interestingly enough, John Foster Dulles was one of the lawyers on the American side of the delegation, and he fought for Germany, fought for the initial armistice agreement that Germany would not be forced to pay that reparation payment, but he lost. He lost out to the other forces. And eventually, yes, this created a lot of hatred on the German side. And the injustice eventually led, as you rightly said, to the outbreak of the Second World War.
And, of course, they made impossible demands on the Germans. The Germans had to pay pensions to all the German, all the Allied war veterans, pensions for, and pay for the disability payments, and pay for all the damage that had been done. And of course, you go back and you study the history of the First World War, and I believe it was really precipitated by Great Britain. But be that as it may, the promise had been made. I mean, they'd all given their word, and then once the armistice was signed, they all went back on it. And the Germans, as a result, hated the people who burdened them with debts that they knew could never be paid, led to the runaway inflation that destroyed the savings, the life savings of the German people, and laid, of course, the bulwark for the rise of Adolf Hitler in Germany. and was the bulwark behind the Second World War. So we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Martin Erdman as we explore this part of history. If you don't understand history, you can't understand today. Well, Dr. Erdman, go ahead, pick up the story there. And certainly we were talking about the unfairness of what happened at Versailles.
Yes, correct. It was basically the Article 231, which stated that Germany was the sole perpetrator of the First World War. And this very article was written by Philip Kehl. Philip Kehl, who was that member of the Roundtable Group, associate of Lord Milner, a very close friend of Lionel Curtis and John Foster Dulles. And this individual, Lord Philip Kehl, who is also known as Lord Lothian, wrote that very article. And then later on, he betrayed himself as a proponent of the peace movement in order to set up a world government during the Second World War. He became also the foreign minister, of a foreign ambassador of Great Britain to the United States.
In fact, it was the time of the Second World War. That was coming down the line.
Yes.
And now, of course, did you have an opportunity of going to the papers there at the Rhodes House?
I was at the Rhodes House Library on the campus of the Oxford University. I was able to read these papers, indeed. And as a matter of fact, yes, some of that research eventually flowed into writing the pieces. So there is substantial documentary evidence to support every claim I make in the book.
Well, of course, it's beautifully documented. But did you ever have a feeling that maybe they were withholding some of the information from you, that it was not readily available?
Well, it was extremely difficult to get a hold of it. At one time, I also did my research at the British Museum Library, where I also had access to most of the documents, but at one time I asked for some documents which were given to me, but I had to go to a special room. I had to be guarded at every single moment. I was not allowed to take out any of the documents out of that room. The guard was standing next to me watching what I did. I was able to jot down a few information and then had to give back the documents to the guards.
Well, of course, why, after all these years, would they be keeping this secret? It sort of sounds like the 9-1-1 commission we had recently, or the Warren Commission report into the assassination of President Kennedy. Why, 50 years or more after these events, would they be concealing, well, even more than 50 years? It sounds like a place of 75, even 100 years of some of these events. Why would they be concealing this information?
Well, they know exactly that this is extremely dangerous information if it gets out to the public.
In other words, they really don't want the public to know the truth.
This is correct. They exactly know how dangerous for their side of the issue this information is.
And, of course, we're talking about many of these events took place, certainly the Boer War was, 100 and, it ended about 104 years ago,
yes.
The First World War, of course, ended, 80 years ago. And, of course, this information is being kept secret. Why? Why are they trying to keep it? Do you think that the American people, the people of the world, would be upset to realize that there really is an effort to destroy national sovereignty?
They would be extremely upset if they would know all the information. And as a matter of fact, I thought it wise not to include the most
Hold that thought. We'll be right here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Martin Erdman. And Dr. Erdman is a Christian scholar who had the opportunity of going through the papers at Rhodes House. Now, that is, of course, where the papers from Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner and the other people who were part of what was known as Milner's Kindergarten are. And Dr. Erdman notes that there were a lot of information he couldn't get. He even went, of course, to the British Museum to get information, and some of this, why they would only let him go into a room with a guard who watched him at every moment, and he was limited in what he could jot down in the way of information. Were you allowed to copy any of the papers there on a copy machine?
I was not, no.
And of course, this is one you do. I mean, how much of this can you remember? Can you jot down? Unless you're going to write this all out longhand. So there's really been a conscious effort to conceal this information from the public, and Dr. Erdman feels that the reason they don't want the truth out about many of these events that date back over 180 to 100 years dealing with these eras was because they're afraid the American people would be very unhappy, English people as well, to realize that there is an organized effort to end national sovereignty. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, this is very correct. The reason why I picked that particular time period from 1919 to 1945 was because at that time, these leaders in Great Britain and America were still more upfront with their real goals. Later on, they tried to conceal their true objectives even more than they did at that time. But at that time, they were still a fairly idealistic. I would put this word into quotation marks because they exactly knew what they were out to accomplish. But they used idealistic language to, again, as I said before, to deceive the American public. And it was an effort, a concerted effort, to deceive the American public in particular.
You're talking about one of my friends, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, has written extensively on this. And you quote, of course, the things that Arnold Toynbee said. He was a historian who wrote, was engaged by this group to write the history. But, of course, I think he wrote the history according to the way they wanted it. But yes. Toynbee at one time had said, you know, we say one thing with our mouths, but we do another thing with our hands.
Yes.
And they could not let the American people know what the plan was then, and they certainly can't let them know today as we are being plunged into what I fear is World War III. But we have to understand this period to understand where we are today, for as George Santayana had said, that those who cannot remember the past are certainly condemned to repeat it. Well,
yes.
You said that you started to say it there, that there were certain things that you didn't cover that that you realized, of course, they might be even too controversial.
Yes. Well, indeed, I was not able to. As a matter of fact, I cut out a whole chapter,
Okay. Eventually
out of the book.
Well, what was that on? I bet that's the chapter I would love to have read.
It was the chapter about Cecil Rhodes.
All right. What do you want to talk at all about Cecil Rhodes? Because I think he is a pivotal figure in history, and the average American has really totally unaware of his influence.
Yes, well, Cecil Rhodes was a Freemason, and he brought in a lot of the ideas from Freemasonry into a secret society which he himself set up. And that secret society was really the nucleus of the whole effort. As a matter of fact, Lord Rothschild, probably the richest man at the time, was also part of that secret society. And I thought, well, it was extremely difficult for me to make the connection between the secret society of Cecil Rhodes and the Round Table Group, which was set up by Cecil Rhodes' successor, Lord Milner. And because of these difficulties, I had no doubts. I had some documentary evidence making the connection, but to present it in a thesis which would be accepted at a British university, I thought it wise not to include that particular aspect in the thesis.
Well, I think that's at least I'm glad you got the doctoral thesis, and I'm glad you got the book published. But of course, there is fortunate that we have information. Of course, the man named William Stead, who I'm sure you're acquainted with,
yes.
Actually in his biography, written about it, they simply quote his papers. But he wrote
yes.
a number of things about this secret society that he was part of. But that's a little different. We want to stick to the things in your book. But I'm so glad that at least you are aware of this, because I don't think most people can understand anything going on today unless they understand that there really have been secret societies. There are people who are concealing what they're doing. They have a different world vision, because in my estimation, they worship a different God. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Martin Erdman, and as we explore what he's laid out in his book, Bringing the Kingdom of God on Earth, or Building the Kingdom of God on Earth, an effort by a group of men who are going to transform the world. And ladies and gentlemen, they've succeeded. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I guess this is Dr. Martin Erdmann. It's very early over in Switzerland where he is at the present time, and we've been talking about his book, and really he traces the history of John Foster Dulles, who was a lawyer who worked for Sullivan and Cromwell, one of the leading law firms in New York City, and then, of course, his influence. So would you like to talk a little bit about John Foster Dulles and really how this whole thing was coordinated through these organizations that control the Protestant church to bring about this world government and this whole process from 1919 right up until 1945.
Yes, well, the main individual in the book is really John Foster Dulles, who eventually became Secretary of State under President Eisenhower. I'm not dealing with that particular aspect of his life. I look into his life as the lawyer of Sullivan and Cromwell, but also primarily as a very active individual within the council, within the Federal Council of Churches. He presented himself to be a Christian, but I also go in one chapter into his personal life, his personal religious sentiments, and to my knowledge, according to the evidence I read in different books, different biographies written about John Foster Dulles, I concluded that he was really an atheist. He had no true Christian conversion experience. He was an atheist, but he portrayed himself to be a Christian. He was invited by many churches to preach from a pulpit, but what he preached was a political message. It was not a Christian biblical message. It was a political message, a message to use the churches, to use the Christian people in America to send letters, for example, to the president to demand the establishment of a national organization with America being part of it.
Well, it's sort of like deja vu all over again. I'm getting things regularly, faxes and emails from Christian leaders telling me, of course, to get everybody I know to vote. And of course, here in the United States, why, God is a Republican. If you didn't know that, why, God is a Republican, and that's why we have to support the one political party, because, of course, the other people are not, you know, God doesn't favor the other side. Well, of course, that's not true at all. I mean, God is really in control, and I think he must look and see what's going on today. And the way, of course, his name is being used to manipulate good people into supporting what I believe is basically a corrupt atheistic system. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Erdmann. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Martin Erdmann. We're talking about his book, Building the Kingdom of God on Earth. And Dr. Erdmann was saying that certainly the book traces the life and activities of John Foster Dulles from 1919 up until 1945. But after reading all sorts of books and biographies on John Foster Dulles, Dr. Erdmann is convinced, as I am as well, that John Foster Dulles was not a Christian. Oh, he professed to be a Christian. He went to churches and he preached, but all his message was always a political one. Get in, you know, right to the president, you know. And, of course, the underlying theme was this idea of creating a world government, this idea that man was going to create a world government and really keep this sort of this platonic utopia that Ruskin had written about. Would that be a fair statement?
It's very correct. They did want to set up a world government, as I said, but it is also interesting to know and to realize that many of the Christian leaders at the time were extremely happy to have John Foster Dulles on their side. As a matter of fact, they were trying to get some political influence via John Foster Dulles because they knew that Dulles was extremely well connected to the president, to a lot of the cabinet members. He was also a founding member of the Council on Foreign, the Commission on Foreign Relations. And I also found out that some of the key Christian leaders at the time, for example, Reinhold Niebuhr and Walter van Kirk, were also members of the Commission for the Council on Foreign Relations. So they were extremely well connected, and the members of the same organization pushing the idea to get America to become part of a world government.
Well, now, where does the Council on Foreign Relations fit into this overall scheme of things?
It's a pitiful organization, really. It was set up, as I said, in the States, New York City. Many financiers, bankers, some politicians, some university professors were part of it. John Foster Dulles was one of the founding members, and they wanted to set up a world government because they knew they could only dominate the world economics and the world's financial system if they would be in charge of a world government. So it was also an idea which had immediate connections to the world financial system.
And I think that's really what's so very, very important that most people don't understand is that people of great wealth have really funded this movement for many years, but not necessarily out of altruism or idealism, but as a means of gaining control of really the finances of the world. Would that be a fair statement?
This is a very fair statement. This is the main reason why they did it.
And, of course, it's so interesting. We had a political race here in Connecticut recently where, of course, Senator Lieberman, a longtime United States liberal senator, was defeated in the Democratic primary by a man named Ned Lamont. Nobody had ever heard of Ned Lamont. And, of course, I couldn't help but smile as I was reading your book. And you were writing about a man named Thomas Lamont, who was there at the Versailles Peace Treaty back in 1919. And, of course, that is Ned Lamont's grandfather. And, of course, Ned Lamont is two generations down the line, from this very powerful banking family, one of the richest banking families in the whole world. And yet, of course, we're told Ned Lamont, who's just will be the Democrat candidate for the Senate in Connecticut, is an unknown. Unknown. Anybody who knows the power structure realizes that, two generations ago, his grandfather was there, one of the founding members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and certainly a member of the inquiry. And you go a little bit into the inquiry. I think that this is a fascinating group because, really, that's sort of a forerunner of the council, isn't it?
This is correct, yes. It was put together by Edward Mendelhaus, who was the unofficial foreign secretary of state, the unofficial secretary of state of America. He was the altered ego of President Wilson, as he was called at that time, a very close counselor of President Wilson, and he organized the inquiry of a little bit more than 100 individuals here in the States who were looking into the issue of a peace settlement before the war had actually ended. And the solution which they proposed was, again, how can America become part of a world government? What can we do as politicians, as financiers, as professors, in order to condition the American public to accept the idea that it should give up national sovereignty and become part of a larger international organization?
And, of course, this was back in 1916, 17, 18, and, of course, then they went over to Versailles, to just outside of Paris, in 1919, and negotiate the Paris Peace Treaty. And here you see all of these people, what was this, 87 years ago, something like that. And their whole purpose at that time was a world government. And you had Colonel House is certainly one of the most interesting figures in history because he had not only almost a hypnotic control over Woodrow Wilson, he also had that same control over Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Did you look very much into House? Because I think he is a pivotal character in this whole story.
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I read all the books which were published about him or on him, and some of the books he himself wrote. He wrote the the history of the Versailles Peace Treaty and his involvement in it. It's a four-volume series of books. And he goes into great detail to show his own role in manipulating the politicians at the time to succeed with their particular schemes which they had cooked up in the background.
And really, of course, today why we have Henry Kissinger, who administration after administration really runs things. And, of course, you can't understand Henry Kissinger's part that he plays unless you understand the part that, of course, Kurt Edward Mandel House had played, you know, almost 80 years or more ago. So, I mean, it's like deja vu all over again. And, of course, history really is leads to an understanding of what's going on today. Well, these people certainly were dedicated to forming a world government. They were dedicated to the concealment of what they were doing from the American people. And, of course, by 1945, they were on the verge of creating what they felt at that time was a world government in the form of the United Nations. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, it is correct. Let me just retrace the idea again. They tried to use the British Empire to set up a world government. And when they realized that this would not work because America was not willing to become part of a British Empire again, so they really dismantled, destroyed the British Empire. This is the reason why we don't have a British Empire anymore. The very persons who were at the top of a British Empire ruling it destroyed it. And when they put all their force behind the League of Nations and thought this would be eventually their treasured world government. But again, at the end of the First World War, America refused to become part of the League of Nations. Again, the very persons who set up the League of Nations then destroyed it because America didn't become part of it. And when they thought, well, we need to get the American public conditioned to accept the idea of a world government, calling it United Nations, using the churches to propagate that idea, taking time, taking 10, 20, 30 years to propagate that idea, using another world war to convince the American public to become part of a United Nations, which they thought would be a world government. And as we know, they succeeded. The American people eventually were willing to become part of the United Nations and accepted that idea in 1945.
What part did these people play, do you think, in creating the Second World War? I mean, did they bear any responsibility for the terrible tragedy that ensued there?
I allude to that fact. I was not able to really state it explicitly. But I allude to that fact because I found some evidence in regards to the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, where some of these individuals were already planning to start the Second World War several years prior to its beginning. And so I do have other documentary evidence which really points to the Royal Institute of International Affairs to be the main organization which pushed for the outbreak of the Second World War.
Well, can you go into that at all? Because I think that is really so vitally important. Because I mean, people don't want to go to war. They don't want to send their kids off to die and or come back crippled. And yet, here these intellectuals are. They want a war because that's how they're going to bring about their world peace. What sort of evidence did you find in that?
It was really Lord Halifax, who was a member of that Royal Institute of National Affairs. He was also a very close friend of many of the people we have been talking about, Jacques Pasteur, Lyle Curtis, Philip Kerr. Lord Halifax was the foreign minister at the time, or just prior to the outbreaking of the Second World War.
He was a foreign minister then of Great Britain, right?
This is correct. And he was even slated to become prime minister, but eventually was defeated by the Churchill group. And Churchill became prime minister, but he was still a very powerful individual in the background who was able to manipulate the politicians of his time, especially the Polish politicians, to stand up against Hitler. And we don't need to go into the story of Hitler. I'm absolutely opposed of just about everything Hitler did, but still there were other individuals responsible for the outbreak of the Second World War, and the most responsible person is Lord Halifax.
And I think that's really such an important factor. And of course, there was a group there, the Cliveden set. Did you get a call in the Cliveden set, which was really sort of an outgrowth of the Round Table, Cecil Rhodes Round Table, or Lloyd Milner's Round Table?
Yes, the Cliveden set was also very instrumental in all of that. It was basically set up by Waldorf Astor, who was obviously an American citizen who became a British citizen, bought the house Cliveden, and at that house many of these individuals met to make plans how they could start a war which would be large and horrible enough for the American public to look for a peace solution which would include the setting up of a world government.
And that's such a horrible thing to contemplate, but I'm sure it's absolutely true. I think that they didn't get their first World War the first time around. They needed a second try. And did that sort of surprise you at all when you began to uncover these facts?
As many of the things I didn't know, because I was taught a whole different story when I went to school. But just looking at the documentary evidence of documents which these particular individuals wrote themselves, it was very surprising to me to find out that the story was very different from a story which is normally told and broadcast over television in history channels.
And, of course, the thing is that those people who write the history, many times change the history so that the public will not know the truth. And this is the great tragedy of our time. And the part that Lord Halifax and the Cliveden set and the others played in actually fostering World War. Not that Hitler, you can make any excuses for Hitler. He was a wicked and evil man. But he also had a great deal of help from people who were never punished for it. And just the same way that after the Second World War, many of the Nazis were either helped to go to South America or brought to America by American intelligence, the CIA and the OSS, but we never talk about that. We have our ideas, and they're created for us by the people who have written the history, or usually part and parcel of these groups. Well, that's fascinating. I'm really so glad that you have the opportunity to get a lot of this in. And, of course, there's been they always were holding meetings, weren't they? Meetings of one sort, Geneva Convention or conventions here, there, or elsewhere, always trying to build public support for their ideal of a world government.
This is correct. What you also need to know, which was absolutely surprising to me, was the fact that John Foster Dulles supported the German war effort.
John Foster Dulles supported the German war effort?
This is correct. He was an aide to the person who was in charge of all the German industry in the United States, especially the chemical industry, which was connected to IG Farben, which was the largest chemical cartel at the time, under German control. They had some firms in the States producing chemicals which were shipped to South America and picked up by the Germans, war-critical chemicals which were picked up by the Germans in South America. And John Foster Dulles was the person making this happen.
And, of course, this course puts an entirely different complexion on things, because if he was helping the Germans, then, of course, they intended to use this war. They had to have a strong Germany if we were going to have a war.
This is correct. Yes, this was the thinking behind it. He also was covering his bed because he had also an office in Berlin. Even while America was at war, he kept his office of Sullivan and Grumbel in Berlin to be able to also converse with the German politicians at the time.
And, of course, these are the parts of history that you're not going to get elsewhere, and it's really so important that, you get the information. Dr. Erdman, do you have any sort of a website or anything you'd like to get out in the way of information other than the fact you've written an excellent book?
I do have some websites which are all in German, unfortunately.
All right, well, I'm afraid.
So it would not be much of a help to your American audience.
All right, fine. Well, we appreciate that, and you hang on. We'll be back in just a moment as we begin to wrap up this evening's program. Our guest has been Dr. Mark Erdman, and I hope that many of you want to get a copy of this program and of his book as well. Well, Dr. Erdman, we've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What are the other thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, it was a fascinating story and research which I did, and it really helped me to understand many of the historical facts which affect us today. I think the book is extremely relevant for our current situation because we understand, now looking back on the history of the United Nations, that it has not become a world government as such. Certain elements are still missing. For example, a World Bank and different other things, the capacity to tax the world's population. So it is not yet a world government. And the very same forces who set up the United Nations to be a world government realize that they still have some work to do to get to the final destination. And thus, I think some of the main wars which are fought in our time are connected to the idea of, again, trying to convince the American public to accept a revised version of the United Nations, which would then be a true world government.
And I really think that's exactly what's going on today. I really do fear that we are moving into even expanding the conflict in the Middle East, which doesn't make sense from a logical point of view. But if you realize, of course, there are people who believe we need to wage war to bring about peace. That's the only way we're going to get a peace is to continue waging even a worse and more frightening war. It doesn't make any sense, but neither does the idea of the United States attacking Iran, and yet apparently that's on the books. We'll have to wait and see. Well, Dr. Erdman, I really appreciate your getting up so early in the morning to be with us, and I really appreciate you writing the book. It's been fascinating, and I hope we get a chance to talk with you again sometime.
Yes, well, it was a pleasure for me to be on your show.
God bless you, and thank you so very much, sir. Good night.
Bye. Bye-bye. Goodbye.
And, of course, our guest has been Dr. Martin Erdman, who is, of course, a Christian ethicist and approaching history from a Christian point of view. And, of course, as he's researched, and this is a book that obviously take many years of research, isn't it interesting, as he points out, how even, 80 to 100 years after many of these documents were written, they're still concealing them. Why? Because they cannot let the American people know that the First World War and the Second World War and the Boer War and the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the First Gulf War and, yes, the current wars in the Middle East are all fought to bring about world peace and a one world government. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope many of you enjoyed our program this evening with Dr. Martin Erdman. And if you'd like to get a copy of the complete text, and of course, remember, we talk through the advertisement, so we get a lot of information there. And if you'd like to get a copy of the tape, they are available through Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. Much of the story is covered in a book we carry entitled Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Quigley, who has also studied this. He actually had the opportunity of actually going through the secret files, and he actually got the information. And when I was back at Georgetown University, I copied all of the information that Professor Quigley got, and that he was allowed for 2 years to study the secret files of this secret organization. And, of course, we copied that when we were back there before. Anybody could go through and destroy the records. And we even got the interview that we offer, the interview with Professor Quigley, where he tells you how his book was suppressed. And he tells you about these crazy right-wingers who believe that the emblem on the back of the dollar bill is the emblem of the Illuminati. And he says it with such disdain. And then he says, well, I can demonstrate that's been around for 6,000 years. The emblem on the back of the dollar bill, and he's actually right. That is the emblem, of course, is the ancient mystery religions. Of course, what's it doing on the back of the dollar bill? Well, that's another story. You need to see the video or DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. You need to see the Millennium by Megiddo 1 or Megiddo 2 videos. But The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning is so important. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to begin to understand what energized Cecil Rhodes. And, of course, that poem we start our book with, the immense and brooding spirit still shall conquer and control. Living he was the land, and dead his soul shall be her soul. And, of course, that was a tribute to Cecil Rhodes at the Rhodes Monument there in Cape Town. The immense and brooding spirit still shall quicken and control. Living he was the land, and dead his soul shall be her soul. And of course that's what it's all about, quickening, coming back to life. Cecil Rhodes rules the world today. So, ladies and gentlemen, we hope many of you go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. We want to remind you about our Sunday conference. That is Sunday, October 29th. We do hope many of you can come. We're bringing in outside speakers. It's all day long. We're serving lunch. And, of course, we look forward to seeing you at the Radio Liberty Yearly Conference, the 29th of October. That is Sunday, the 29th of October. And if you can make it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We also, of course, want to remind you, Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you are in a position to help us, we could certainly use the help at this time so we can maintain our network of about 60 outlets every single week as we begin to try to reach people with the stories that you're not going to get elsewhere. There really are secret societies, but behind all of them are occult organizations. And their goal is a new world order, a one-world government. Recently, Henry Kissinger wrote an article, an op-ed piece, that appeared in the Washington Post. Now, if you go to the Washington Post website, you can't get it. They pulled it down, but what he said in essence was that, we are facing a world confrontation, a war of civilizations, and we have two options. We can either build a new world order, or we can face global catastrophe. We can build a new world order or face global catastrophe. It's the same old. The same old thing that they fought the First World War about, the war to make the world safer democracy, the war to end all wars. And, of course, the Second World War was fought to bring about a world government. All of the wars are fought to bring about a world government. And we are going to be plunged into a horrible, horrible war very soon, unless we can convince the American people the truth about these evil and wicked people and the spiritual forces that energize them. Please pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, again, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV. War, because we are at war today.